Welcome to the latest edition of the IDEA Podcast, brought to you by the Irish Development Education Association. I am your host, Maximiliana Mtenga. In today's episode, we dig into contemporary crises and issues through the lens of global citizenship education. This discussion is a continuation of our webinar entitled We Need to Talk About Gaza, which took place on March 6th this year, 2024. We are privileged to have with us Dr. John Reynolds, an Associate Professor of International Law at Maynooth University. Dr. Reynolds is the author of The Empire, Emergence and International Law and an editor of the Third World Approaches to International Law Review Journal and website. He was one of the esteemed speakers at our webinar. Stay tuned for an insightful conversation. How are you, Dr. John?
I'm grand, thanks, Maximiliana. Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. Our topic today is the role of international law in tackling contemporary crises such as war in Gaza and other emerging crises. Let's dive into our conversation. Can you tell us how you first became active on Palestine?
Sure, yeah. I was studying in Galway. I studied law originally, and then I was doing a master's program in human rights law and international law in Galway at the Irish Centre for Human Rights. And the centre there has some long-standing connections and partnerships with some of the Palestinian legal and human rights organisations. And so when I was finishing up my master's program, they had a little bit of money available to support students who were about to finish and wanted to go to do work placements or internships or travel to do human rights work. And so I had got very interested in Palestine. I mean, I always had an interest growing up, just following a little bit what was going on and thinking about some of the connections and kind of shared histories with Ireland and Palestine, but started studying it a lot more properly and in depth, I suppose, over the course of my master's, and was just keen to go over there and see how it was and get a sense of it myself. So I went initially for 3 months to do a job, came up and ended up staying longer. So I was there for a few years at that point and worked on various different research projects and litigation projects. And since then, that's a good number of years ago now, but since then I've had an interest, strong set of connections and friendships and colleagues that I'm still in touch with over there, and have continued to work with in different kind of ways and shapes and forms. And so even though I've kind of gone on to do academic research, my PhD in academic research and a book on different topics, there's always been a thread relating to Palestine running through my work and my interests, and as a researcher and a teacher, and also as an activist and someone interested in the struggles for justice and liberation there, just trying to do whatever we can to support that work and the movements there.
Building on that point, what role do you see international law playing in resolving the ongoing crisis in Gaza and similar conflict worldwide?
Yeah, so I mean, it's not an easy question. I wish it was an easy question to answer there, but there is a complication and a contradiction that we have to just be honest about, I think, at the start with international law, which is that historically, you know, international law has been very heavily complicit and implicated in colonial oppression around the world. And the reality is that for many centuries, international law was part of the colonizing project, was used and shaped and formed and influenced the European colonial powers in how they asserted sovereignty and how they dispossessed indigenous peoples around the world. And so there is a darker history of international law there. The idea, the narrative, the story that international law tells itself now is that has, you know, well, it kind of ignores that part of the history, and it kind of situates international law as this progressive order since the Second World War, which is there to remedy the problems with international relations and the lack of protection of peoples that was there before, and that sets peace and security and accountability and justice. But we see, you know, Gaza is a classic example of how that's not so straightforwardly the case. Now, that's not to say international law doesn't have a role to play, but we do have to admit and acknowledge that there are still, you know, 400 or 500 years of unequal global relations and imperial oppression and so on, that's not going to be able easy to work out of a system of institutions and structures and political and social relations very easily and very quickly. So those, some of those structural biases are still there, even though the UN is more egalitarian than previous iterations of international institutions. We still see the problems with the big powers, for example, holding a veto power at the Security Council and obstructing things. And we've seen, you know, a number of examples since the Gaza genocide started of the US, for example, using its veto to obstruct, you know, even basic ceasefire and humanitarian resolutions, most recently to block the recognition of Palestinian membership of the UN. And so there is, you know, important tools there, particularly when it comes to, you know, the language and the framing that we use. We have for a long time heard about, you know, the Israeli system as an apartheid system, or in the context of what's been happening in Gaza the last 6 months, the unfolding genocide. And indeed, these are quite, you know, obviously loaded historical terms, but what international law does is give us a definition and a set of tools and criteria to understand what they are and apply them in a an independent and objective way. And the findings that international human rights organizations, UN agencies and special mechanisms, and now the International Court of Justice have said, you know, in different at different stages along the way, that Israel's form of domination over the Palestinians is an apartheid regime, or now that the Israeli onslaught in Gaza is a form of genocide, that then creates a set of duties and obligations, not just for Israel to stop those violations, but also for international third states and international institutions to be able to respond and intervene. All states have a duty not to recognize or assist or aid or abet an illegal situation like an apartheid domination, or not to, they have a duty not just not to recognize or assist a genocide, but an active duty to prevent genocide. And so this is what some of the UN special mechanisms and special rapporteurs have been pushing states that to do, that to say that now there is evidence of genocide or potentially genocidal violence going on, that means you have an immediate legal obligation to stop selling any weapons to Israel, to stop trading with Israel in any way that could assist or support or be associated with the genocide. And we have these set of cases also going on against Israel and also against Germany for supporting Israel at the International Court of Justice, where we have already some provisional language and rulings from the International Court of Justice saying that Israel has to cease and desist from perpetrating genocide and prevent its military from continuing to do what it's doing and allow unhindered humanitarian access and fact-finding missions to enter. And so there's important language, there's important tools and a set of obligations there that we can all use in our different capacities in responding and pushing our own institutions, whether that's government institutions, companies that are trading with Israel, universities that have relations with Israeli institutions and so on. What the International Court of Justice has said about not aiding or assisting genocidal violence is relevant to all of these institutions. It's not just about accountability for the part of the Israeli state itself.
Listeners might also be interested to know a number of things, including how can educators who are passionate about human rights and global justice leverage international law to address these crises more effectively?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one way, like if we think about education, think about the role of human rights, social justice, language and concepts in as an education tool in explaining to students, trainees, people that we are educating. You know, there are, I think, very useful tools there to, and a lot of it just is about distilling. You know, sometimes there's this idea or this sense that international law is very complicated, and we look at, you know, what's the definition of genocide, or what is a war crime under international law, for example. And you know, we can get bogged down in the density of like a 200 or 300 page judgment from the International Court of Justice. What did it say when Bosnia alleged Serbia was guilty of genocide during the wars in the former Yugoslavia? And there's a huge amount of dense detail there, but there are also useful ways to distill that information, to convey it in an accessible way. There's plenty of materials that can be used that, you know, human rights organizations, the International Court itself does its own summaries, and there's ways that we can distill and in an accessible way what, you know, what the International Court or the UN resolutions have said about, for example, the situation in Palestine or the situation in Gaza recently, and use those as, you know, as kind of a case study and template materials to try and explain the situation. Because again, on the other side of it, there's a sense also that the situation in Palestine is so historically complex and loaded, and it can be quite difficult to disentangle the various different religious, political, cultural, economic kind of elements of the contestations there. again, you know, some of the, you know, in some ways it is hugely complex and contested, but in other ways, you know, there's ways that we can break it down and just think about, you know, the, for example, if we think, you know, people will say, well, it's better to talk about Palestine, the situation in Palestine as a colonial situation rather than a conflict, right? Because a conflict implies there's maybe a parity or a symmetry between two equal sides who are engaged in a fairly evenly divided struggle over resources or land or access to power. But in reality, it is, you know, a long-standing kind of domination by one much stronger military nuclear armed state over a much relatively weaker defenseless population. And so you have, you know, with international law, for example, the Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 49 says it's absolutely illegal for one state to build civilian settlements and transfer its own population into the territory of another people, because that's a form essentially of colonization. If you occupy a territory as a military power, the sense is that occupation is only a temporary situation in a post-war transition before you hand back power over to the people themselves in that territory, and that any occupation in a temporary situation, while there's a reorganization or restabilization after a war, that should be done in the interests of and in trust of the people that are there. And so the idea being that you can't take over their territory and start to build your own cities and settlements and colonies to seize and annex territory. And that's, you know, what Israel has been doing in the West Bank for more than 50 years now. And it's a very, very clear, simple rule that essentially says they can't do that. The International Court of Justice has said it's illegal that they can, that they are doing it. The UN Security Council has said, even, you know, in recent years, despite American support generally for the US, for Israel, even the US has accepted, you know, and can't deny the argument that the settlements in the West Bank are illegal. And that then again gives rise to a whole set of legal consequences and implications. And that's why you have the Irish government or other governments around the world being called on to, for example, ban trade with of goods and produce from these illegal settlements to not give them that economic lifeline that they have through selling produce and services around the world. And so there, you know, it's an example, I think, of, you know, using that rule that exists as an example to show the laws of war and humanitarian law and occupation say settlements are illegal. Settlements are illegal because it's a form of colonialism. Colonialism, certainly as we understand in Ireland and many other countries around the world, is, you know, an absolutely unacceptable and untenable system of relations, and so has to be dismantled and ended. And the implication then, you know, where this comes to, I think, helping us to understand and address the crises more effectively, as you put it, is that in a situation of colonial domination, you can't wait around for negotiations to be conditional on, you know, everyone agreeing that we have to, you know, that we have to work together. There's certain first principles that have to be implemented immediately and straight away, that you can't wait for Israel to accept that what it's doing is wrong or to come to some kind of compromise solution. You know, the right to self-determination, the right to be free from colonial domination is an absolute one. And whatever about, you know, finer details of a longer term settlement situation for Palestinians, is they can't be forced to wait for, you know, the dominating power to agree to conditions that at the moment it's, you know, it's showing no sign of doing.
So, in relation to what you just said, what action can educational institutions take to promote a better understanding of the crisis in Gaza and action in solidarity with those people facing injustice and oppression?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's very, you know, ultimately, like the role of an educational institution obviously is to educate. And so I think there's very simple things that can be done to just help students and people at the institutions to better understand the situation and be better informed about it. There is a sense sometimes people kind of feel, oh, I don't know enough about it I feel that there's, you know, this is not right what we're watching on the news every night, you know. Children being massacred, people being intentionally starved, and the, you know, dire situation that Palestinians in Gaza particularly are in. It seems all so wrong and unfair and unjust, but I just don't know enough about it to know how to talk about it, how best to intervene or respond if I want to do something in solidarity. I'm not confident to do so. And so just again, you know, basic kind of educational tools. There's some very good materials on some of the organizations that are focused specifically on political education of the situation in Palestine. cast iron. One is called MAKAN, M-A-K-A-N, which is a British-based Palestinian political education organization. There's another one called Decolonize Palestine, who have some very useful, accessible entry point materials on their website. Both of those have useful videos. There's a colleague of ours, Noura Erekat, who did a series a number of years ago now called Gaza in Context, a series of videos and kind of explainers on Gaza specifically, which long predates the current kind of situation in Gaza, but is very much relevant to understanding the history and the context and the dynamics there. And so just show, you know, having screenings of these little video materials or having little reading groups about some of the basic kind of fact sheet and Q&A materials, just to help people to understand the situation better and then be able to feel that they're able to respond. And in terms of, like, you know, my sector I'm in, the third level institutions, we had a big nationwide, all island wide day of action this week that was organized on Wednesday there across campuses across the country. The organization Academics for Palestine that I'm involved in was part of that, but it was led by a group that came together called Third Level Campuses for Palestine, which was led by a combination of admin and academic staff across different campuses who felt that, you know, they felt a little bit let down, to be honest, by the lack of statement, lack of action, lack of engagement really at all from most of the third level institutions on this issue. Students and staff have been writing to management and institutions over the last 6 months, asking them to make a statement, to take some action, to review any ties they might have with Israeli institutions that could make them complicit. You know, basic, straightforward, simple things that we've been asking the universities to do, which they've been very reluctant to do. The University of Galway was the only one that's made a quite strong, substantive statement a couple of months ago in February, saying that they, you know, calling for a ceasefire. Some of, you know, things that are really just the basic minimum things that centers of learning should be doing, you know, and it's, most of them have done way less, have been, you know, reluctant to even adopt a similar line to what the government has done. And Galway did make a statement saying, you know, calling for a ceasefire, condemning the situation in Gaza, referring to the International Court of Justice decision, and saying on that basis, and on the basis of, you know, all of the push and the calls for the European Union to review its association agreement, it's basically free trade access agreement that it has with Israel, which has a human rights clause and makes Israel's preferential access to European market and European institutions conditional on respecting human rights, which obviously it hasn't been doing. And I mean, you know, when I was first in Palestine, that was 2006, and at that point, you know, we were continually writing to the European Union saying there is this human rights clause in your agreement with Israel, can you not see that it's being violated every day? It's taken up, you know, to the point of tens of thousands of people being massacred and a possible genocide for there to even be some European states like Ireland and Spain calling for that agreement to be reviewed. But even, you know, that they're still calling from the outside, and it hasn't become the consensus position among the European Union yet. So the Irish universities were not even willing to, in general, go as far as the government has been going. And so people, you know, the students particularly have felt quite let down and distressed in many cases that the institution isn't taking this seriously and speaking for them, speaking on in response to what they've been asking. So they're, you know, but I think a lot of it took a number of weeks and months to build the momentum and the understanding and the knowledge of how best to organize a day of action like this, about what the demands should be on the institutions that would be requested, and to have confidence across the board from, you know, staff, students, admin staff, academic staff, that everyone would feel empowered enough and confident enough to know what were the basic things that they want to be asking for and how could we best do that. And then there was some really creative, you know, and inspiring kind of solidarity actions that took place across the country then on the day, between, you know, drama recitals, poetry readings, performances on campuses, major rallies and student walkouts and so on. And there was I think 18 third level institutions, and nearly all of them participated in some shape or form, north and south, and all had their own twist on how they wanted to organize it and do it. And that's, you know, the product, I think, of having a number of education sessions and teaching sessions that we've been doing over the course of the last number of months to help, you know, people better understand the reality of the situation in Gaza and feel then enabled and empowered to act in solidarity.
Apart from institutions and educators here in Ireland and international, what can activists and individuals do to support the application of international law in these situations?
Yeah, I mean, again, number of things that people can do. I think the solidarity marches have been, really significant that have been going on in Dublin, around the country in Ireland, but also around the world, nearly, globally now, nearly every Saturday in some shape or form, or every weekend in some shape or form for the last 6 months. And the size and the scale of the demonstrations and the marches has been bigger than we've ever had on for anything in relation to Palestine, and as big, if not bigger, than many of the movements, the anti-war movements, for example, in response to the war on Iraq and so on. And so that, I think people in Palestine do see that and value that and appreciate that. I mean, sometimes it can feel a bit futile. We're going marching every Saturday, calling on the government or calling on X or Y institution to do something, and they're not actively or specifically responding in the way that we want. And so it feels futile. But certainly for people in Palestine, it's not, it is, it's so important for them to feel that they haven't been left behind, that by the world, that the people of the world don't agree with or endorse the actions of the few small number of disproportionately powerful states like the US or Germany or whoever, who are arming Israel, sending them all the military aid and equipment that they want, and providing them with the political and economic cover to keep doing what they're doing. And so for Palestinians, that, even those symbolic solidarity actions are important and do feed into, like, for example, I'm quite confident that the case that South Africa brought ultimately against Israel at the International Court of Justice was on the back of those, those solidarity movements pushing and calling for that. Like, since October, very early on in this situation, there were international scholars, international lawyers, genocide experts, and then the UN special experts from like mid-October onwards, talking about the risk of genocide and genocide starting to happen and so on. And so a lot of the solidarity movements were uniting under this banner of stop the genocide, end the genocide, and calling on their governments to invoke the Genocide Convention to bring a case or some actions against Israel on that basis. And so that's, I think, what, because the South African government, particularly more than many governments, is responsive to its social movements and has, quite a serious kind of dialogue with the social movements, and the Palestine solidarity movement in South Africa has a particular influence there because of South Africa's own history of struggle against apartheid and the importance of global solidarity in the anti-apartheid movement. So that all, I think, fed into the decision that ultimately the South African government took to bring that case. And so, even if it doesn't feel like directly we're having an input, I think certainly indirectly it does matter and it does count. And that is, basically the people, a popular kind of movement to enforce international law, basically. And similarly, in the Irish context, once South Africa took the case, the solidarity movement in Ireland was asking the Irish government then to intervene in support of the case. And, if you look at the shift in language of the government's position from late December, early January, when South Africa first filed the case, and at that point, the Irish leaders, the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach, were saying, we're not sure about this. Genocide seems like a very strong terminology to be using. What about October 7th and what the Palestinian groups did? That was also, maybe could that not be genocide? And they were, very equivocal, very reluctant to commit to, even accepting the premise of the case, never mind actively intervening in support of it. But as things moved on, once we got the provisional order from the court, and once the court had said, this is a serious case to answer, they started to shift the language, saying, okay, we will consider intervening. And the kind of movement kept calling for it, kept the pressure on. And now we have, as of last month, we have the government saying that they will definitively, that they will intervene in the case, and talking about how, the possible intervention that they could make around, stuff to do with the forced starvation and the deliberate imposition of kind of unlivable conditions on the Palestinians, that could be a form of genocide, and that Ireland could provide a legal analysis that could be useful in support of South Africa's case. And so again, these are all things that are pushing governments to do more and to do better in terms of enforcing international law. But then there is also what I call, I suppose, the popular enforcement of international law. The boycott, divestment and sanctions movement is based on the originally goes back to the International Court of Decision, Court of Justice decision in 2004, that said the Israeli wall in the West Bank and the settlements were illegal, and that third states had a duty to start to not to recognize that and to cooperate to bring that illegal situation to an end. Once states weren't actively doing anything to follow that or adhere to that, popular movements and civil society took it upon themselves then to say, okay, we're going to act towards enforcing that through calling for divestments of funds from investment in Israeli companies companies or military sector technologies and all of that, but also just, you know, refusing to lend support to the Israeli economy through buying Israeli goods and services. And so all of that is in towards enforcing, you know, some of the basic principles of international law that the BDS movement is based on, you know, the right of Palestinians in the occupied territories to be free from occupation, right? So that the occupation should end, as the International Court of Justice has implied it should. That's number one. Number two is for equality for all Palestinians in historic Palestine. So whether they're in the West Bank or Gaza or inside Israel, that there is a system of structural discrimination and systemic discrimination there that should be ended, and there should be equal rights and equality for all, regardless of which area of the territory they're in. And thirdly, then, for the Palestinian refugees who've been displaced since 1948, since 1967, and now a new wave being displaced for the second or third or fourth time from Gaza, that all of those refugees should have a right to return as they are entitled to under international law. So these are all legal principles that are being enforced by popular actions. And so, you know, it's a combination of taking what actions, whatever small actions we can do individually in our own personal capacity, as well as pushing our governments and also our institutions. And if it's a case, you know, that we work in a school or a training center or a third level institution, there are ways that, you know, our own institutions can be pushed to take a position in line with international law, whether that's making a statement, whether that's cutting ties with a complicit entity or investment fund or whatever it is. And again, generally just organizing events, doing film screenings, gathering to discuss what are the implications of what these various different legal institutions are saying, and disseminating their materials as well. And just one useful resource actually that's also come out recently, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, Francesca Albanese, her last report to the Human Rights Council was also focused on the question of genocide. She called it the anatomy of a genocide. And she goes through, again, it's because of the word limits on the UN reports, it's quite a concise, accessible document that breaks it down, you know, quite clear terms, how and why, you know, what's happening in Gaza is best described and characterized understood as genocide, and what the implications are of that for all of us. And so even just, you know, sharing that document, discussing it with students or among ourselves, and thinking about how can we best make use of these resources in our own spaces and places.
One last question before we close our conversation. I was reading an article published by The Conversation asserting that academics can change the world if they stop talking only to their peers, meaning ideas and their vast knowledge about international law, for example, is not understood by the publics, but only among the peers and law gurus. How can we change this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Like, you know, the whole question of whether academics can ever change the world is an interesting one. I haven't read the article now, but I must read it. But, you know, there is obviously the famous quote from Marx, you know, that the philosophers or the intellectuals have only interpreted the world, and the point now is to change it. And so I think, you know, obviously it's about the connection between learning and knowledge production on one hand, and then practice on the other hand, or what some, I suppose, critical education and liberation education theorists like Paulo Freire would talk about as praxis, right? And so the combination, like, kind of informed activism based on our theoretical and intellectual knowledge production, right? And so on one hand, there's an obligation on us as academics or as teachers to bring our knowledge, our ideas, our research into the public sphere. That can be through publishing it in places that are more accessible to the general public. There is obviously a major issue with the kind of gatekeeping world of academic publications. That is, you know, it's something we've been pushing a lot in the institute, in the university sector, to make sure that more of our research is open access and freely available. But, you know, there is a pretty horrendous kind of capitalist monopoly that controls, you know, a small number of publishers, basically commercial publishers, controlling huge amount of the knowledge and information that is produced and published but not accessible. And so there's a duty on all of us, I think, to make sure we are publishing our work in places that are more accessible. And if we have an academic article that's behind a crazy paywall in an academic journal that's only on a database that, you know, fancy institutions can afford to pay and not ordinary people, we have a duty to publish a version of that, or a shorter or more accessible version of that in an open space in a newspaper or magazine where people can get access to the ideas. Increasingly now, obviously, with all of the possibilities that webinars and online technologies offer us, there is, you know, obviously a way to access a wider audience much more quickly. The importance of doing public lectures in local community centers, even in a university, but in a way that's open to the public. I think that's still very crucial, and there's no replicating an in-person event, but you know, there's a huge amount of possibility and scope now with reaching a greater audience through online webinars and online education formats. So that's, you know, that's a big part of it. And I do think, you know, there is a space, you know, if we talk things for certainly and specifically about international law, like the live broadcast of South Africa, the presentation of South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, I think is probably the most watched day of proceedings at the International Court that there's ever been, because some of the news outlets took it up and broadcast it, but also just, I think, because of the general, just really that at that moment was speaking to the outrage and the sense of injustice that a lot of people had about what was happening in Gaza, and they saw South Africa presenting this case in a way that was, you know, and a lot of people have made this point, that was South Africa not just speaking to the court and the judges in a very legalistic way, but speaking with Palestinians and giving voice to the Palestinian perspective, and going beyond just the technical legalistic arguments about the Genocide Convention, and talking about, you know, the history of the Nakba in Palestine and what Palestinians went through in 1948, the nature of the kind of apartheid and colonial regime that's been imposed on them since then. And so that, you know, I think seeing some of the lawyers, the South African legal teams, so eloquently and powerfully articulate that case in a very human way, I think that, you know, really spoke to people. And so, you know, there's a lesson there, I suppose, for us as international lawyer, legal academics and researchers about how to, you know, use that format, use the clips from the footage in our own presentations and lectures, and convey, you know, the tools that are available to international in international law to use, without necessarily, you know, over romanticizing them or giving them a power that they don't necessarily have, but that we certainly do want to push for, you know, a more just response to the situation. And so, you know, I think a lot of it just is about, you know, having conversations, going into spaces that we might not, you know, that are beyond just what we are obliged to do as part of our jobs, to teach the students in the classroom that we're in, or presenting in academic conferences that are, like you say, quite insulated kind of spaces, and just making sure that we are, you know, putting some of the ideas and information and learning out there that's useful to ordinary people on the street, to activists who want to have more knowledge and information to do more, to councillors and politicians and political representatives who might want to push on a certain point, but, you know, need some legal argumentation to get the point across to their peers. And so, you know, for all of the flaws and limitations with international law that I spoke about earlier, at the same time, it is, you know, it does have a gravitas and an authority. And if you could say, we should do this, not just because I feel it's the morally right thing to do, which, you know, we should do, that should be enough, and we should do it on that basis because it's the right thing to do. But if it's the right thing to do, and it's also what the thing that the International Court of Justice has said we should do, then that, you know, it does give an extra weight to it. And I think that's important. That's, you know, one important role that that international lawyers can have, or human rights advocates can have. You know, if we think about our arguments and the tools we have available to us as tactics that are in support of a bigger picture strategic goal, which ultimately in this case is freedom and equality and justice for Palestinians, how can the bits of information and knowledge that we have be used in a tactical and effective strategic way to feed into that overall goal? And if international lawyers are doing that, and if also, you know, media studies experts, for example, are bringing their knowledge to the table and doing their studies and showing the nature, you know, how the nature of the reporting is biased against Palestinians in so many Western media organizations, and how it's dehumanizing Palestinians, and how we shouldn't use that language and that framing, and we should speak about it in this way instead. And so we have the media studies experts, the international lawyers, the economists, the development and humanitarian experts, the social scientists, the international relations experts, you know, everybody bringing their own knowledge and specializations to the table to help us better understand the situation, then we have a more informed view overall. And one of the other big areas that's come up a lot with the destruction of life in all of its forms in Gaza in the last 6 months is the role of also environmental researchers and climate experts to, who've made some strong interventions talking about, the environment, the kind of dire environmental consequences of the attacks on Gaza, the implications of the weaponry and the gases and so on that are being used, the destruction of deliberate destruction of agricultural sustainability, and questions of, how this attack on a territory and a people in Gaza is symptomatic of a broader kind of ecocide and destruction of the planet. And that, because that's also then a way to bring environmental activists and movements who might not necessarily have focused much or had Gaza or Palestine much on their radar, but see it, understand now that it is not just an issue about Gaza and the Palestinians, it's also an issue about environmental and ecological sustainability. And if we allow wars like this to happen in one place and then they spread to another place, we're only accelerating an already catastrophic climate situation. I think really the one crucial point that's come up so time and again in the last 6 months is how this is obviously first and foremost about protecting Palestinians and people on the ground from death and destruction, but that it's bigger than that as well, because of how support for Israel is such a key function of so much Western foreign policy, that this is also about, and the Colombian president made a very powerful speech about this at the COP summit before Christmas, how what's happening in Gaza now and how we respond to what's happening in Gaza is a rehearsal for the future. Because there will be, if things continue on the track that they're on, there will be way bigger waves of climate refugees and environmental displacement in the years to come. And it'll be a question on how do the powerful countries, the powerful industries respond? Do they respond in a compassionate way that shows solidarity and looks after people who are at risk and suffering, or do they respond with genocidal violence? And that will be something that will, potentially affect many populations, not just the Palestinians. And so this is, you hear a lot of Palestine being talked about as a litmus test or a kind of a moral compass for so many other issues. And I think that really is true. And so, again, so many sectors of research and specialization are implicated and can contribute to better understanding this situation. So we do, that is kind of incumbent on us all.
Thank you so much, Dr. Reynolds, for accepting our invitation to join us for a conversation on our podcast. We hope to welcome you next time. Have a lovely day.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
This episode is funded by the Irish Aid at the Department of Foreign Affairs. Irish Aid is the government's overseas development program. Irish Aid also supports global citizenship education in Ireland to encourage learning and public engagement with global issues. The ideas, opinions, and comments therein are entirely the responsibilities of the Irish Development Education Association and do not necessarily represent or reflect the Department of Foreign Affairs policy.